Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Afney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about another country that I, for one, love and that I believe is vital to the security of the United States. That would be the state of Israel. And we're going to talk to a man who is deeply knowledgeable about the challenges Israel is facing, as I believe are we from the so-called Palestinian community. His name is Itamar Marcus, and I'll introduce him in a moment. But first, the Gaffney Brief for today. I want to talk to you a bit about a problem. It's a somewhat unique problem. It's not often that you see something that is very big, very problematic indeed, that something can be done about, and done about in the very, very near future, in fact. One such problem, however, is the emergence of this idea that we want to turn over to private corporations the management of public lands, public waters, public air, as well as private property for the purposes of constricting the use that can be made of such resources, for farming, for example, for extraction of minerals or oil and gas or lumber. These are the sorts of things that so-called natural asset companies are being proposed to restrict, in fact, to prevent, and to do so with obvious implications for, well, our food supply, our energy security posture, and more. This is the brainchild of the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, the Chinese Communist Party, the Biden administration, of course, and sort of radical globalists more generally, to help engineer permanently further movement in the direction of addressing climate change. If all of this does not sound terribly sensible to you, you're absolutely right. And I strongly encourage you to take a look at a webinar that our Committee on the Present Danger China did recently on this issue at presentdangerchina.org. And then take action with a click of a mouse or two at sovereigntycoalition.org. You can let the Securities and Exchange Commission know you don't want these natural asset companies to take over our lands to the great detriment of our society and its people. Sovereigntycoalition.org. Please act today. Let me further introduce Itamar Marcus. Itamar is the director of a marvelous organization, Palestinian Media Watch. He has been monitoring and reporting impressively for, well, I think 2 decades or so now, about what Palestinians are actually saying, as well as what they're actually doing, that is not faithfully described, unfortunately, in most media outlets, particularly since the advent of the war in Gaza with the invasion of Israel by the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas. Itamar, I so appreciate the work you do at Palestinian Media Watch, and I'm so grateful to you whenever we have a chance to catch up, because your truth-telling, by basically just presenting the verbatim quotes that are pushed out by various governmental entities, whether it's Hamas on the one hand or the Palestinian Authority on the other, or from pulpits in this community or other vehicles, it's stunning. And there's such a contrast between what we learn from you and Palestinian Media Watch and what we're hearing from most other reporting. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us, my friend.
Thank you very much, Frank. Always great to be with you.
So I want to level set here, because we are being endlessly told that if only the Palestinian Authority is given more authority, more control over not just the West Bank, but also Gaza, post-Hamas, let's say, that all will be well, that there will be peace, that there will be two states living side by side in peace. you have, I think, demonstrated amply that's not the case. Walk us through why we're being told that it is and why, in fact, it's not.
The Palestinian Authority is, in everything but except designation, the Palestinian Authority is a terror organization. If we look at its messages to its people, as its education to its children, Israel has no right to exist. We look at their relationship to terror. They have been promoting terror and glorifying terror, honoring terrorists, naming schools after terrorists, naming streets after terrorists. Everything about the Palestinian Authority means that they're a terror organization. Because they are the only alternative, the international community, and like the United States as well, have been pushing Israel to try to reach agreements and to try to give land and be more forthcoming with the Palestinian Authority. And the more we do that, the more terror is entrenched. I'll just give you one example. The United States is very proud of what they call the security cooperation. Well, a few months ago, the Palestinian Authority and Fatah, its main party, decided to publish a picture of 30 terrorists who were also a poster. It has the poster of 30 faces, and each of these faces were members of the security services, were also terrorists, and they all died in their terror attacks. And the Palestinian Authority is proud of them. It's proud of them. They're proud of these terrorists that they're also members of the security services. So what's happening is the United States is training these people. The United States is giving them the weapons. They're going out and killing Israelis, and the Palestinian Authority is bragging about this. The Palestinian Authority is, I repeat, a terror organization in everything except designation.
Yeah, and it should be designated, it seems to me. But Itamar, you've just described a situation that I've heard is increasingly alarming to Jewish residents in this area known as the West Bank, settlers, they're called, who have been reporting about the increased preparations, it appears, on the part of these so-called security services to use the kind of arms that we've given them, which include, as I understand it, armored vehicles, to attack Israeli communities in Judea and Samaria, perhaps with even more brutality and, you know, atrocities than what Hamas did in the areas adjacent to Gaza. Are you hearing that, and is that in fact a concern?
I think it was definitely a concern, not just of the residents of Judea and Samaria, the Jewish residents, but it was a concern of the Israeli army. Since October 7th, Israel has arrested over 3,000 terrorists and potential terrorists, and Hamas members, Fatah members, members of all the different terror organizations. So Israel decided, as tragic as October 7th was, and there's no way of describing, you know, the tragedy. It's just unimaginable. But at least Israel seems to have learned from this. And instead of just sitting back and waiting for terrorists to come at us and try to stop them in Judea and Samaria, we immediately took the initiative. And like I said, we've been going to Palestinian cities every night, arresting terrorists. Everyone who's on the list as potential terrorists, we're arresting them. Like I said, we've arrested over 3,000 already. And in fights with the terrorists, we've already killed, I think, close to 200 in this short period. So Israel is not going to be caught surprised like we were.
Well, if that's so, praise God, because it's been suggested that some of the people who are making these kinds of warnings have been told, much as I think people in Gaza were, or adjacent to Gaza, that, you know, settle down. This is under control. We'll come back with more on this with Itamar Marcus on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Rarely is a major problem with profound implications correctable with a single action, especially in the near term. One such problem, however, is at hand in the form of a radical environmental proposal being stealthily advanced that would have the effect of permanently removing public lands, water, and even air from productive use and endanger private property rights as well. Rabid globalists, including the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, the Chinese Communist Party, and of course, the Biden administration, want to create and weaponize so-called natural asset companies to restrict U.S. food production and the exploitation of minerals, energy resources, and timber, all ostensibly to mitigate climate change. Fortunately, we can stop this devastating unconstitutional initiative by opposing, before January 18th, a proposed rule the politicized Securities and Exchange Commission is poised to approve. Join us in doing so at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with the director of a wonderful organization based in Israel, Palestinian Media Watch. I really commend it to you because there's nothing like seeing firsthand what is being said by those we're told are Israel's partners for peace and people to whom a new state can be safely turned over. It's simply incredible when you see what I think Itamar has rightly described as a terrorist organization in all but designation, carrying out incitement against Israel and, let's be clear, folks, against Western civilization as well, us included. Itamar, I did just want to pick up on this point. You mentioned, and it's a good thing, as far as I can tell, that Israel is trying to take terrorists that are operating in the West Bank off the battlefield, imprisoning them, awaiting presumably prosecution. What we've seen ever since the 7th of October is this idea that those are the kinds of people, these prisoners are the kinds of people that Israel ought to free in exchange for getting hostages out of the Gaza Strip. What are the implications of this kind of particularly mass release of individuals who you've, I think, properly described as people deeply imbued with this, I call it Sharia supremacist belief that it is their duty to God to liquidate Jews and their state?
Unfortunately, Israel is desperate to get, we have 100 and I think close to 30 hostages who are kidnapped, who are still in Gaza. And there's tremendous pressure by the families, rightfully so, I don't fault them at all, to do whatever it takes to get them free. Now, the Hamas wants Israel not only to release these new prisoners, that's 3,000 who I just mentioned, they want us to release people like Abdullah Barghouti. Abdullah Barghouti, responsible for the murder of 65 Israelis. He was a Hamas bomb builder, and he's serving 65 life sentences. They want us to release Ibrahim Hamad, serving 55 life sentences. Abbas Assayed, 35 life sentences. Abbas Assayed planned the Passover Seder suicide bombing that killed 31 people. These are the monsters that that Hamas wants Israel to release. Now, the reason why Israel hopefully won't ever give in to these demands, the leader of Hamas, who was responsible for this entire terror attack, terror atrocity of October 7th, his name is Yahya Sinwar. He was in an Israeli jail for life, had a life sentence in an Israeli jail. And he was released in a previous prisoner exchange, in order to get Gilad Shalit, one Israeli soldier who had been kidnapped, released, along with another 1,000 terrorists. And those 1,000 terrorists who he released have been responsible for the deaths of thousands of Israelis. So hopefully,
since their release included.
Since their release, exactly. Yeah. Since their release.
And there's a further irony to all this, as I understand it, that particular jihadi was actually given life-saving heart surgery, as I recall, by the Israeli medical community. And, you know, he's gone on to carry out so much damage. It's unbelievable. But this speaks to the determination of the people of Israel to try to live in peace. And it has been denied them, not for want of trying, I believe, but by this, well, I can only describe it as a religiously based, not necessarily the case that all Muslims follow these Sharia instructions by any means, but those that do are the kind of people that are determined, whether they're Palestinian Authority tied folks or Hamas tied folks, to destroy Jews, are they not?
Both the Palestinian Authority and Hamas interpret Islam on two parallel tracks here, one regarding the land of Israel and one regarding the people, the Jews. Regarding the land of Israel, they both say that Israel exists on holy Islamic waqf land, and therefore every Muslim has a personal obligation to liberate that land from the infidels, so that Israel can never be accepted as a permanent state, and any agreement is only tactical until Israel will be destroyed. Hamas and Fatah agree about this. The second thing is, not only does Israel not have a right to exist, they both agree that Jews don't have a right to live. They all quote the Hadith, the Islamic tradition, the hour of resurrection will come until Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. Literally, calling for the extermination of Jews as a condition for redemption of humanity. Both Hamas and Fatah promote this part of Islamic ideology, which, like you mentioned, not every Muslim holds this, but both Fatah and Hamas hold this. So what are the two most significant things when you talk about the Islamic side to this war? Both Hamas and Fatah agree that Islam prohibits the existence of the state of Israel and calls for the elimination of all Jews.
Yeah. You know, this chap, Saleh al-Aruri, who was, as I say, taken off the battlefield by somebody. Israel has not claimed credit for it. In Lebanon, in Beirut, in fact, was a man who, prior to getting into the jihadi line of work, was an Islamic scholar, we're told. Talk a little bit about, you know, the connection between Hamas and Hezbollah that is evident in the fact that one of Hamas's senior leaders was operating deep inside Hezbollah-controlled Lebanon.
So Hamas is a Sunni Islamic organization. Hezbollah is a Shiite. They really should be hating each other and fighting each other. But what they've decided is to put their religious disagreements aside for the meantime, because they want to unite to destroy Israel. So they will help each other. They will fight together. As soon as Hamas started its war, Hezbollah started its own war, shelling Israel from the north. They, I think, don't dare try a ground attack because Israel has probably a good half of our army up there in the north. But Hezbollah wants Israel to be destroyed. Hamas wants Israel to be destroyed. And in spite of the fact that there is a major, major ideological rift between the Sunnis and the Shia, they're willing to unite to try to kill them.
So, something that I recall very vividly back at the time of some of our issues in the Middle East with Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, we were told that couldn't possibly happen, but it obviously does, and it's not unique to this time in history. When there's a common enemy, they will join forces. And of course, behind them both and funding all of this is another Shiite entity, the jihadi regime of Iran. To the extent that we're now being told that Hezbollah may retaliate against Israel for this this incident, this attack, this successful assassination, if that's in fact what it was, do you anticipate, Itamar, that this will further intensify the collaboration between these assorted jihadis and their determination, in fact, to wipe Israel off the map.
They are completely determined. You can't even be more determined. They might increase strategy. I think for Lebanon, for Hezbollah in Lebanon, I think their honor was hurt very badly here. I think their honor was hurt because Israel killed this senior, number two in all of Hamas, right in their territory. So I think their honor, and we have to know that with countries like Hezbollah, with organizations like Hezbollah, honor is so important. So I think their motivation to punish Israel, unfortunately, is even going to be greater.
We have to leave it at that. Itamar Marcus, stay well, stay safe, and thank you for joining us today. We'll talk with you in the near future, I hope. We'll be right back with more.
Thank you.
Right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very happy new year to all of you, of course, but also to our next guest. He is the great Gordon G. Chang. He is one of our regulars, I'm very proud to say, at Securing America. He's a man who has been incredibly prescient and, I think, effective in raising awareness about the threat we face from the Chinese Communist Party. You, for example, can check out his terrific book, The Coming Collapse of China, as well as his writings at places like the Gatestone Institute, Newsweek, Epoch Times, and beyond. Gordon is to be followed, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang, and also here, of course. We're always very appreciative of his time. And again, a Happy New Year to you, my friend. It's good to have you with us.
Happy New Year, Frank.
I'm not banking on it for reasons that we'll be talking about in the course of the next three blocks, and I'm very grateful to you for giving us an extended opportunity to talk with you, Gordon. I wanted to start with reports that, in addition to the incessant effort by the Chinese to intimidate and even threaten Taiwan with aerial incursions and ship encirclements and the like, we now have actual balloons from China overflying Taiwan itself, evidently. I imagine these aren't weather balloons. What do you think?
Yes, there have been a number of balloons. Some of them have been in the Taiwan Strait, but one of them actually overflew the island itself. And that, of course, is an extremely provocative act, an act of war. It's also probably counterproductive for Beijing. Because Taiwan's going to hold national elections on the 13th of this month for president and for the national legislature. William Lai of the Democratic Progressive Party, the party that Beijing abhors, was doing very poorly, actually, about a couple weeks ago, because people were focusing on the failures of DPP governance, Lai as vice president. But as people have started to focus on China, Lai has pulled ahead, and now he has about a 12-point margin, which is really stunning for a couple weeks. And this is because people are starting to think about China as a threat. And when people do that, they naturally tend to go to the Democratic Progressive Party. So I think William Lai has to send a big thank you to Beijing.
Gordon, it's a very interesting point. The Democratic People's Party has historically been supportive of, if not outright independence from China, at least, you know, maintaining the status quo. Where do they stand at this particular juncture, and how do the Chinese perceive the prospect of a victory by them?
Well, William Lai has tried to continue the line taken by the current president, Tsai Ing-wen, also of the Democratic Progressive Party. And essentially it is, you know, we're going to maintain the status quo, as you said. Also that they will assert Taiwan is already a independent country. So there's no need to, quote unquote, declare independence, as many people say. And they're willing to talk to Beijing on the basis of equality. Now, unfortunately, Beijing won't talk to Taiwan on that basis. And essentially, Lai has primarily two opponents for president. Both of them have said that they could handle Beijing better, but they've been extremely vague. And basically, they have not been able to show the Taiwan electorate that they can deal with Beijing on a better basis.
And it's my understanding that both of them are more, shall we say, aligned with China on the idea that, you know, there does need to be some kind of normalization, if you will, of the relationship between the two, which sounds an awful lot like submission to Beijing. Is that the case, Gordon? And again, would the Chinese regard the defeat of those guys by a guy who is openly talking about, you know, Taiwan as an independent nation as a causus belli, as they say, a provocation leading to war?
Well, William Lai looks like he's going to win, although the DPP probably is going to lose its majority in the legislature. So that might placate Beijing a little bit. But yes, they will view his election as a provocation, maybe even as a cause of war. But we've got to remember that the other two parties, which are more aligned towards Beijing's views, their election isn't going to make things any better. And the reason we know that is because one of those two parties is the Kuomintang, or the KMT, or Nationalist Party. They were actually in power with Ma Ying-jeou from 2008 to 2016. And relations really weren't that much better than they've been under Tsai Ing-wen. I think the problem for a Kuomintang presidency, or a presidency from the other party, the Taiwan People's Party, is that they will be under pressure from Beijing to, you know, basically surrender. And they can't surrender because the people of Taiwan won't let them. That means that Beijing will view that as a provocation for their failure to accede to Beijing's demands. So whoever gets elected in Taiwan, there's going to be a lot of tension. This is not Taiwan. This is an issue of Chinese belligerence.
Yeah. And I want to come back to that, Gordon, because it's not, of course, just manifesting itself in Taiwan at the moment, but in a number of different places and quite possibly on an increasing scale in our own country. But before we do, I wanted just to come back to the balloon business. We have had a number of revelations of late about the balloon that the Chinese notoriously sent over our country early last year. One sort of lie, I guess, has really been exposed after another. Initially, that the Biden administration knew about this balloon, but wanted the rest of us to remain in the dark about it, and then knew about its true character and wanted us to believe it was a weather balloon, and then knew that it was actually meandering over strategically sensitive sites and tried to prevaricate about that. And then not least, Gordon, we've just learned that it was known by the Biden administration that this balloon was using a U.S. Internet provider to communicate via satellite back to the mothership in Beijing, and lied about that as well, which makes all the more unbelievable, really, that knowing all of that and lying about it, but knowing all of that, that they allowed this thing to meander all over the country without actually taking action to shoot down what was obviously a spy balloon collecting sensitive intelligence and sending it back to China. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, the Pentagon, apart from the Biden administration, the Pentagon deserves great criticism. From all that we can tell, they did not inform the commander in chief until the fourth day of the incursion over territorial U.S. airspace. So I think that there should be at least the Secretary of Defense should take responsibility for this by resigning. So there's that.
So they knew. They knew, but you're saying that they did not tell the National Command Authority about it?
They did not tell him until like the fourth day. Now, the Biden administration, yes, they tried not to tell the American people. We know that from the NBC News reporting. So that is obviously a failure on the part of the commander in chief himself. But also, there was a guy named Mark Milley, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah, also known
he
as
gave
General
an interview
Milley.
To CBS News, in which he said to the American people publicly that this balloon did not collect and send back information to China. He had to know that that was false. He lied to cover for the American people. I think that possibly a court-martial would be in order here, largely because we have seen on the part of Mark Milley some very, very disturbing things that he's done with regard to China.
Yeah, notably his call to his counterpart there, telling him that he would give him a heads up if Donald Trump decided to attack China.
That was insubordination. That could very well, some people say it's treason, but clearly it was insubordination. He deserves to have a court-martial.
Yeah, I agree with that, Gordon. I'm very pleased that you've made that point here. Gordon, when we last talked, there had been some indication that there's considerable churning going on under Xi Jinping inside the Chinese military. At the time, I think you felt that that was evidence that, you know, they were not ready for war. There's been still more of that, I think, since we last talked after the holidays. Give us your reading on both what's happening there and its implications.
Well, both in the military, which is a Communist Party organ, and in the civilian parts of the Communist Party, there has been turmoil. We don't know exactly what's happening, but clearly there's intense infighting. Now, in the military, just at the end of the year, they appointed a defense minister. The former defense minister had been not seen in public since August 29th. The announcement of his formal removal was October 24th. The fact that there would have been such long delays indicates that there is disagreements at the top of the Chinese military. In the rocket force, which controls almost all of China's nuclear weapons, 70 people have been disappeared in the second half of 2023. And the list goes on things that have occurred recently. So clearly the Chinese military is in turmoil.
Hold this thought. We'll be right back with more with Gordon Chang right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Rarely is a major problem with profound implications correctable with a single action, especially in the near term. One such problem, however, is at hand in the form of a radical environmental proposal being stealthily advanced that would have the effect of permanently removing public lands, water, and even air from productive use and endanger private property rights as well. Rabid globalists, including the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, the Chinese Communist Party, and of course, the Biden administration, want to create and weaponize so-called natural asset companies to restrict U.S. food production and the exploitation of minerals, energy resources, and timber, all ostensibly to mitigate climate change. Fortunately, we can stop this devastating unconstitutional initiative by opposing, before January 18th, a proposed rule the politicized Securities and Exchange Commission is poised to approve. Join us in doing so at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. We're visiting with the great Gordon Chang, one of our regulars and rock stars here at Securing America. We're always pleased to have a chance to catch up with him, especially to take stock on what we know and what we think is going on inside the Chinese Communist Party and its intentions going forward. And Gordon, we were talking a little bit about the turmoil, the purging that seems to be taking place at Xi Jinping's hands within the senior ranks of particularly the strategic rocket forces, which is an important element of the military of China. This coincides with a report that was in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week about China having basically put both its military and its society on a war footing. And by contrast, one would argue that neither our military nor our civilian population is anywhere remotely on such a footing. Give us your take on that assessment. The specific focus was the unbelievable amount of shipbuilding that's been taking place. We've discussed it here before, but do you agree that war footing is what Xi has gotten his society, whole of society, if you will, on as well?
Well, Xi Jinping can't stop talking about war, but it's obviously more than that. It's the fastest and largest military buildup since the Second World War. We know he's trying to sanction-proof his regime. He's stockpiling grain and other commodities. He's purging officers who are opposed to war. He's supporting the war efforts of Russia and Iran. And he's mobilizing China's civilians for war. So yes, this is a society on a war footing.
And when you look at that, and you, again, contrast it with what he knows about the vulnerabilities of our society, does that prompt a heightened level of concern, as you see it, about what we were just talking about, the possibility that he may seize upon the outcome of the election in Taiwan next week as a, you know, a causus belli, a grounds for achieving the reunification by force, as he likes to call it, of Taiwan and China.
Yeah, there will be more belligerence after the election, regardless who wins. But really what we're seeing right now, the real war risk is not so much Taiwan, I think, but is really the Philippines. Because for the last several months, going back basically half a year, we have seen warlike acts of war against Manila at Second Thomas Shoal, Scarborough Shoal, Whitsun Reef. And so there is a really dangerous situation. Excuse me. The Biden administration has issued written and oral warnings to China that the United States was prepared to use force to discharge our obligations under the 1951 Mutual Defense Treaty with the Philippines. but China just ignores them, which means that there's no deterrence.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that is particularly concerning, Gordon, as you've indicated, when you look at not only what China is doing itself, but the help that it is giving. I've called it, as you know, strategic arson, with the fires set in Ukraine and now Israel and the Red Sea. And I wanted to ask you particularly about developments in North Korea. Not only have we seen a lot of military saber rattling, but a lot of military preparations, it seems, there as well. Is that likely to be another of what I call the bonfires of the tyrannies?
And while we're talking about bonfires, before we get to North Korea, let's talk about North Africa, where across the rim of North Africa, we are seeing insurgencies and wars fueled by Russia and China. So, excuse me, this is the world.
I know fire. Particularly about Algeria and Morocco. You've warned about that here before. Where else are you thinking?
Well, you know, just on Algeria, let's remember that Hamas leaders who were in Qatar, excuse me, have fled, and they are now being housed in the Iranian diplomatic missions in Morocco and in Algeria. The reason why this is important is because in December, Iran said it was going to close off the Mediterranean Sea, and everybody just scoffed at that, said, how could they do that? Well, Algeria is very close to the mouth of the Mediterranean on its western end. And Morocco is actually there. Algeria, which is a friend of Russia and China, is pressuring our friend Morocco. And so if we could see, for instance, Hamas do the Houthi thing and fire missiles into the western part of the Mediterranean, they could actually close the Mediterranean off as effectively as they've closed off the Red Sea right now.
Right. And again, the strategic significance of that is hard to overstate, Gordon. But to this question about North Korea, are we to take at face value the threats of Kim Jong-un to annihilate South Korea and the United States in the event they provoke him in some way?
I actually think so. And I don't think North Korea is the primary actor here. I think that essentially we're seeing Russia and China are going to force North Korea into supporting their war efforts, should there be war in East Asia. In the past, the Kim regime, the Kim leaders have been very adept at playing Russia off against China. They did this in the post-Cold War period. They did this during the Cold War itself. But now that Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are coordinating their policies, I don't think that Kim Jong-un will be able to do that. And I think they're going to force him to go to war if they go to war in East Asia. And remember, North Korea last month tested the Hwasong-18, which an intercontinental ballistic missile can hit any part of the United States.
And would be presumably nuclear armed in that event. Gordon, we have to take another short break, but when we come back, I want to talk with you about a variation on the scenario you've just described, one in which North Korea is another of the preludes to the aggression that China and perhaps Russia may as well engage in the Western Pacific. And another bonfire of the tyrannies that I think is in prospect as well, and that would be here at home. We'll be right back with the great Gordon Chang on all of that and more right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back, and we're delighted to have with us for one more segment our friend Gordon Chang. And Gordon, I just wanted to tease out one issue. You mentioned about North Korea being something that could be pulled into Xi Jinping's belligerence and ambitions, presumably towards Taiwan. I wonder, my theory of the case is that this arson is about trying to maximally distract us from the main action, which I would argue is what China is up to. And therefore that we might see something going wrong in North Korea as a precursor to aggression against Taiwan, not simply something that might happen in the course of it. All of this is perhaps really very near at hand. If there is a response to this election, which, as you say, is on the 13th, namely that something could go seriously bad in North Korea at any time. Am I overstating the case?
No, I mean, we've got to be prepared for any scenario. And we got to be prepared for China to use all of its means, because the next conflict could very well be, in China's mind, the final battle. Got to remember, although the Chinese military right now is in a state of disarray, Xi Jinping has domestic incentives to go to war. And also in terms of Communist Party infighting, he could very well may believe that the only way out for him is to distract everybody with a foreign misadventure. The other thing is that China, just apart from intention, what really concerns me is not so much that Xi Jinping wakes up one morning and says, I need to go to war. I worry about what China is doing at this very moment, which could very well lead to war. And it's not just the Philippines, as we talked about. It's all of these extremely dangerous intercepts, especially in the air, but also on the surface of the sea, that China is engaging in. And one of those could go very wrong. You know, there was one, of course, on April 1st, 2001, the EP3 incident. And that was solved only because the United States backed down. George Bush offered to pay a ransom. He allowed the Chinese to take apart that Navy plane and to imprison our aviators. That was, I think, one of the most disgraceful moments in America's history. And I don't think, though, that given the way the American public views China today, that even a President Biden couldn't do that, what George W. Bush did. So that means, and I don't see the Chinese backing down either. They cannot act responsibly right now. So this is a very, very fiery situation. Anything that happens could lead to war.
Yeah, fiery, again, consistent with the theme of arson here. I actually am given to calling it now pyromania on the part of Xi Jinping. And this brings me to the last point with you, Gordon. We've discussed this repeatedly in the past, but there was a very important article in the Daily Caller this week in which they talked about the Biden administration back in April of last year streamlining the process by which large numbers of, many of them at least, are military-aged, fit young men, unaccompanied, coming through our border. Instead of subjecting them to some 40 questions, they were apparently only going to be asked 5. And we have no idea, Gordon, I don't think, exactly how many of them have gotten into the United States and exactly who they are. But the suspicion that they may be People's Liberation Army personnel is real. And again, feeds into this idea that another of the bonfires could be right here at home. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, certainly. You know, that lab in Reedley, California, that the building inspector accidentally discovered, which turns out to be a secret Chinese biological weapons facility with at least 20 pathogens, including Ebola, for God's sakes, and almost 1,000 mice that had been genetically engineered to spread disease. So it doesn't take too much imagination to think about some of these saboteurs linking up with facilities like that across the U.S. If we go back a couple years, the Chinese who were coming across our southern borders, there were a lot of families. Now, that's not the case. Now, predominantly, the Chinese who are entering our country are single males traveling without family members in packs of 5 to 15, pretending not to speak English, and Border Patrol knows that some of them have links to the Chinese military. I can't think of a more dangerous situation, and to streamline the process for their entry into the U.S. to me is incomprehensible.
Well, it's treason is what it is, it seems to me. And unfortunately, it's just one example of it, especially when you combine it with the fact that we've helped disseminate those folks nationwide. We don't know where they are now, but I think you're right to be concerned about what they may be up to. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm just going to pivot to a quick takeaway for our audience about something we'll be talking about more in the future, and that is the departure at last of Claudine Gay from the presidency of Harvard University. She distinguished herself, I guess one might say, in a rather infamous way with her real anti-Semitic as well as racist remarks in testimony before the United States Congress recently, prompting a lot of people to think that she should go. It turns out that on top of all of that, she was a serial plagiarist and in an institution that prides itself on not tolerating that, she was allowed to persist in the job despite evidence of both the anti-Semitic sentiments as well as her plagiarism. But it has caught up with her. She has now resigned, and I think that's a good thing, both for Harvard University and hopefully for the academy more generally. We had a very interesting conversation with James Lindsay, which we will be airing shortly, talking about the Marxization, I think is what he calls it, of the academy, the academic institutions. This is a classic example of it and must be rectified if at the end of the day we are to survive as a people in America. Stay tuned for more on the academics and the Marxification of them, as well as what it means for all of us. But that's for another day. Until then, I hope that you'll continue coming back for more and that you'll also go forth and multiply.